So I was asked the difficult task to give an introductory lecture to protein folding, so it would be difficult for you, mainly. It will be worse for you if there is no electricity. So it's very elementary, and I use it's a colloquium which I gave here partially and mixed with some other stuff. So what I will, this is the outline of what I will discuss. So I will tell what I was assuming that everybody is ignorant, so I will tell what's a protein. Chemistry, structure, interactions, energy, time scales, etc. Then I will talk about several very simplified models for that, namely hydrophobic effect. And I will spend some time on theta points and Hamiltonian walks, which will be also apparently there is a talk on Hamiltonian walks after. And then I will talk about some heteropolymer models. So what is a protein? So my talk is very much like Ralph on DNA. It's going to be quite simple. So a protein, there are essentially three classes of biological polymers: protein, nucleic acids, and polysaccharides. And they are really the molecules which have essentially the catalytic activity, whereas the other one, DNA and RNA, are used for coding and, or sometimes apparently for they may have some catalytic activity, but mainly it's coding, whereas protein has really a biological function, which can be catalytic, which can be transport either of molecules like or oxygen ion or oxygen. It can be ion channels in membrane. So there are two types of proteins. There are proteins which live in the bulk of the cell, and there are membrane proteins, and they both have quite different structures. There are motor proteins in your muscles. They make up the shells of viruses. The viruses contain pieces of DNA or RNA, and the shell of the virus is usually made of a protein which is there to penetrate the cell and to insert the DNA message inside the DNA of the cell. Prions, which people eat a lot of in England, in France also. Prions are apparently wrongly folded proteins, and otherwise you eat it in food all the time. And sorry, in France a little bit. A little bit. You read the wrong newspaper. Okay, so proteins are characterized by active site, and the most of the biological activity is related to this active site. So a protein, from a physical point of view, it's a polymer. And the size of proteins can range from 10 to few hundreds. Typically, it's 300 monomers. And I say that now because the active site where the biological activity takes place usually involves 10, 20 monomers, no more. So the monomers which make up the protein are amino acids, and there are 20 types of amino acids. This is the general formula for an amino acid. There is a carbon, so this is the amine group. This is the carboxylic acid group, COOH, which dissociates. The H goes to the water, H plus, and you get charged O. And the 20 different amino acids, which are represented by their abbreviation, alanine, isoleucine, etc., are all characterized by a different residue, which is here. So the residue, so it's like an alphabet of 20 letters. And this carbon, which is sitting here, has a chirality because if this residue is not identical to one of these atoms, then the carbon, which is here, is chiral, has a certain definite chirality, and the chirality of all these amino acids is left-handed. So there, except for one, glycine, which is the smallest of all the amino acids, this one, is the residue is just a hydrogen atom, and if you have a hydrogen atom, then you see that there is no chirality. And but otherwise, the 19 other amino acids are all chiral and left-handed. Left-handed means that if you, okay, there is a convention. If you look on the CC axis from here, it rotates, if you look OOHRN, it rotates in a certain direction. But for most of our purposes, left is just contrary of right. So this is the list of amino acids in French. I hope you can understand. So 20 amino acids that they can be grouped in hydrophilic, hydrophobic, charged, neutral. So there are essentially five amino acids which are charged, three positive and two negative. The other ones are neutral, and they are either nonpolar, in which case they are hydrophobic, so alanine, isoleucine, etc., they are hydrophobic, and the other ones are polar, and polar, although neutral, they are polar, they have some dipolar moment, and therefore they are hydrophilic, and soluble in water. What else did I want to say? So that's for the chemistry of a single amino acid, and this is the, I don't know if it's very readable. No. So this is some formulas for the amino acid. So the smallest one is this glycine, so that's the residue which is just a hydrogen atom, which is the only one which is also not chiral. And the largest one is the tryptophan, which is a hydrophobic amino acid, which is, as we heard, a little bit less often seen than the other amino acids, but it has a nice property, which is that it's fluorescent. And in experiment, people measure the quenching of the fluorescence of tryptophan, and we'll hear of that probably in 2 weeks from now. So these are certain other amino acids. Proline is not exactly the same kind of amino acid as the other. And cysteine is one of the two amino acids which has a sulfur atom. And this sulfur atom can make sulfur bonds which are like covalent bonds. Otherwise, I didn't want to bother you with all the formulas. Okay. So then these amino acids can make a polycondensation reaction. And the polycondensation reaction is just that, if you remember here, so this is the start of the protein. Here is a COOH, and here you had NH2. So one of the OH of the COOH goes with one of the H of the NH2, and it makes a molecule of water. And you make a bond here, which is a covalent bond, which is called the peptide bond. And then you can continue, make another peptide bond, etc. And then you have a chain. This is the backbone, or not exactly, but essentially this is the backbone. On the backbone, you have small atoms which belong to OH. And then on the C alphas along the chain, you will have residues, and you will read off R1, R2, etc., RN. And that's the protein. So among the various degrees of freedom, so it's a small polymer, you have hard degrees of freedom, and I will give scales of the energies a little bit later, but essentially the hard degrees of freedom correspond to covalent bonds. So these bonds, we'll see the scale of energy is quite high, so they're like frozen at fixed size and fixed distance. Valence angles are, these angles here are also hard degrees of freedom. Peptide bonds, so the peptide bond is planar, and because there is apparently a resonance of the CO with the CN, which makes it planar, and the planarity of this peptide bond is also something which doesn't move very much, and improper dihedral, that's this 120 degrees angle. And the only soft degrees of freedom, which are of order KT, let's say, are torsional degrees of freedom along the chain. So either, you see, there. So it's usually the chains are characterized by torsion angles. So there is an angle which is called phi, which is the, so you take the peptide bond, and the angle phi characterizes the rotation of the residue around NC alpha. So that's one of the two angles. And the other angle, psi, characterizes the rotation of the second of this peptide plane, peptide bond, with respect to this one. And then you can have, if the residue is large or complicated, you can have rotational degrees of freedom of the residue itself. So you have phi psi along the backbone and several angles, chi, can be chi 1, chi 2, chi 3, etc. And these angles are not, because of steric constraints, because the atoms are, and I will show you some picture, it's very compactly packed. Because of the steric constraint, the phi and psi, and also the chi, by the way, are not distributed randomly, or they cannot take any value. So when you look at a protein with their van der Waals radius, this is what it looks like. So this is BPTI, which is a small protein, a bovine pancreatic trypsin inhibitor. And so it's completely filled. It's a completely compact polymer. This is another one. I think it's hemoglobin, but I can tell you anything. Nobody's going to contradict me. So let's say it's hemoglobin. I can show you a real hemoglobin. So this is there are various representations. So this is called ball and sticks. And the yellow atoms are the sulfur atoms. This I remember is really hemoglobin.
What are reds?
Red? It's oxygen, so it's the water probably from the outside. I will come to that. It's the water which is probably crystallized with the protein. So proteins exist under two states, like DNA, or RNA, or like many polymers. One is called the denatured state, and the other one is the native state. And the denatured state is also sometimes called unfolded. And there, so there is one denatured state, which is sure if you go to, if you put a lot of denaturant or high temperature, if you can avoid aggregation, you have, it's like all polymers, if you put them at high enough temperature, they will just be random coils. So it's a swollen state. Now, people believe that there might exist another state, which is a kind of compact state, but with no definite structure. It's a kind of liquid, compact liquid structure of the polymer, and it's called a molten globule. Now, some people call molten globule different structures where there is already some part of the native structure, but not enough to make it functional. So the denatured state, in the denatured state, the protein doesn't have any biological activity, and so it's. But you can eat it in this form. The taste is probably the same. Sorry. Yes, it's even better. The native proteins, on the other hand, are folded, and they fold in a unique compact structure. So by unique compact structure, I mean that... Yes, then when it is cooked. But when you cook, what happens is that proteins aggregate. And maybe it has a... Maybe aggregation has something to do with the taste. I don't know if it's aggregation or denaturation. It's an interesting... So what's amazing with proteins is that if you unfold them and refold them back, they will go back exactly to the same structure. I mean, the functional shape of the protein in which it has some biological activity is the same. So it's the same microscopic structure which is active.
Is it truly a single state?
Okay. It's believed that it's from a conformational point of view, it's a single structure. But of course, you have vibration because you're at finite temperature, so everything vibrates. But if you, let's say, if you make a coarse grain model or a lattice or anything, then it's a unique structure. That's a belief which, which can be checked experimentally by X-ray or things like that.
So,
or RMN.
So we know of no proteins that exist in two different states.
No. There are proteins which functionally exist in two different states, and that's part of their function. For instance, motor protein exists in two states, and they make transition between these two states in order to advance. In order to, so if you walk like this, the protein does the same. But many of them, so they exist So many proteins have what's called allostery, so they have several shapes, but the number of shapes, two shapes is as surprising as one shape, and 10 shapes is as surprising as one shape. Because if you think of a compact polymer, the number of structures, as I will show a little bit later, is exponentially large. So the fact, so if n is the, let's say, the number of degrees of freedom, this number is absolutely huge, and the fact that every time you select a small number, whether it's 1, 2, 3, doesn't matter. What's amazing is that you select always the same number, the same structures, but mostly it's a unique structure.
Isn't that the local minimum of the phase space of the protein?
Local minimum? No, it's believed that it's a global minimum.
Well, there is a single global minimum, right?
Yes.
For every function, there is a single global minimum, except if there are some that are exactly the same. So these 10 structures that you assume that for some proteins exist must be 10D local minimum, right?
Yeah, well, the what people believe is that the phase space in some coordinates looks has a lot of and there is of quasi-degenerate local minima, and there is one which is deeper than the others, and that's the native state. Now, under certain condition, if you change the chemistry around it, you can pull down another one. By for instance, if you have a protein which binds, which is used to bind to a certain ligand, if you bring the other object close by, the protein will deform, and maybe it will be this shape, which will be more stable and which will bind. But essentially, for the number of ground states, let's say, of useful, biologically useful ground states is very small. It's usually one or two. Which means that there is no conformational entropy.
Maybe,
yes, of course.
Because my misunderstanding, these, if there are two states, they are very similar. It can be taken as deformation of one molecule. It is not like you
it's not a new fold
and make quite different structure. It is deformation of the same structure.
So it's two different conformers, if you like.
You have two globules. They keep the same structure, but in one state they are in this state shape, in another state this shape. But internal structure, anatomy, most of the contact, 99% of contacts,
yes,
are the same.
You can characterize by the native contacts between the various,
yes,
residues, and these contacts are the same.
Like Bartle prions.
Sorry?
Bartle prions.
No.
Of course. No. Yes, but prions are not.
Come in.
Later in the weeks, you mean? So the folding. So there is a phase transition between this unfolded state and the folded state, and this phase transition depends on various things: temperature, pH, the denaturant agents, salt, etc. And that's, I'm talking in vitro, yes, in vitro. Now, in the cell, there is other proteins which are called chaperonins, which help the proteins to refold. So these chaperonins don't, what they do essentially, they don't make it even faster. What they do is they help the refold, and the result is that in the refold in the cell, the yield of refolding is of order one, is essentially one. Whereas if you don't have chaperonin, which play the role of a catalyst, if you do it in vitro, sometimes you reach 20% of refolded, of correctly refolded proteins, or even less. With the chaperonins, it ensures that you will fold essentially always to the right shape.
So what do the other 80% do?
They are folded. They are misfolded.
In some
metastable state or complex structure, but it depends. So the, okay, anybody can correct me.
May aggregate.
Yes, because of course, apparently it is believed that when a protein is folded, it's optimal from the hydrophobic point of view. So if it's badly folded, then they will aggregate because they will have hydrophobic patches. Two large hydrophobic patches on the surface, and then they aggregate. So in that sense, chaperonins help to correct for this aggregation by apparently binding to the wrongly folded proteins.
So on the normal salt concentration, what is the transition temperature? 40 something, or?
Oh, it's of the order. Well, it depends on the protein, but typically it's certain proteins, it can be 40 degrees, it can be 70 degrees. In some thermobacteria, it can be 90, 95 degrees. But it's of order KT, or 1.5, 2 KT.
If you change from the salty water to sweet water?
Then it's the effect is much, much weaker, I think. There is not a very strong effect of salt. There is strong effect of salt if you go to very high concentrations, or when you start very much screening the Coulomb interaction. But the effect of temperature is much stronger, and the effect of the denaturants, the denaturants like urea or so are quite.
Is it known what percentage of protein in chaperone to fold?
In the cell? I don't know. Did you understand?
Most non-continuous protein, that is, protein consists of domain, globular domain. If you have protein consisting of several domains, they often use chaperones. And if you have small proteins, they don't need chaperones, but maybe use.
Sure.
The difference between in vitro and in vivo experiment is that in vivo you deal with very high concentration. Proteins occupy 20% of the volume of your cell, so that they can stick it with each other very easily. In vitro, it is 0.01% concentration of the protein in the volume sense. So the main task of chaperones is to screen proteins from unnecessary contacts. Do you know what is the word chaperone?
Sure.
Who is chaperone?
He's, you mean?
No. What is the duty of chaperone? It is person. It is person who guides a girl and prevents her abnormal contacts.
Good. So the times, yes.
For the naturally occurring. Protein,
sorry, for the naturally occurring. Yes.
Can ever get into glass saturation or temperature?
Well, glass, what you can get is you get the protein in a wrongly folded state, so in a metastable state. I don't know if you call that a glass.
Always that method? Always that misfolded state, or many different misfolded states?
Many different. No, there are not. You cannot. I don't know if there is any experiment where you can where you could crystallize and see the structure of the misfolded states. But my guess is that there are many. No, but maybe there is only one misfolded state. So the time scales which are involved in the folding transition, these are typical. So microscopic time scales are essentially femtoseconds, and they are set by the scale of the vibration of the covalent bonds. Folding times, so when you solve, we'll see very soon, when you solve the molecular dynamics equation, in principle, this is the time scale, the time step that you should use to solve your Langevin or Newton equations. Now, the folding times that you measure experimentally range from 10 to the minus 2 to 1 second. There are certain special proteins which fold much faster than that, fast-folding proteins, and I think people discover more and more of them. But this is quite typical for proteins of size 3 to 400. And
so 10 to 13 is a big number.
Very big. For such a small object.
Do theorists know how to derive it?
Okay, I don't know the theory, which is.
It's an experimental number.
It's an experimental number.
Experimental number is 2 or something, or 2.5. We don't care.
Yes.
Theorists don't care. But if there is a big number, like 13 orders of magnitude, it's interesting to see whether we can derive such a big number, right?
So usually if you have such a big number, you have exponential, right?
Yes, and we can derive it.
Without exponential, it's difficult, or you need large powers. But but exponentials help a lot, so this, the idea, of course, is that you have barriers, and that you have to go through barriers, and when you go through barriers, it takes time. Especially if you have many barriers, and you are going from... So, The picture, which of course is not it's not a calculational scheme, but the picture is if you start here, let's say, you will end up here, and then by thermal fluctuation somehow you have to go there. So that of course tells you that it's not going to be very fast. I don't know any microscopic estimate which would give you the right order of magnitude. But it can be correct.
All,
sorry?
Just take, say, a polymer, hollow polymer.
Yes.
Of length 400.
Yes.
How long does it take to...
To collapse?
To go from one configuration, collapse configuration...
To another.
To completely different collapse configuration. I mean, there may be some sort of scaling with the length, and maybe this number, is it really surprising or...
Okay, what I can tell you is how long it takes to collapse. This is very
but
fast.
That's okay, but you know, if you are...
This is what I calculated.
What I think is whether this number, this 12 orders of magnitude, is it really surprising, or it should be expected?
Well, it depends. I mean, it's a small object. So if you take water, if you freeze water, it will go very fast. Microseconds, and it has 10 to the 23 degrees of freedom.
Sure.
So it finds its ground state very fast, much faster than a protein which has a few thousand atoms.
But you want to go to a specific.
Yes, of course.
So if you start from an arbitrary conformation, go to this specific one, even without energy barriers, how long would it take?
I mean only entropic barrier. So it's a kind of entropic barrier.
Does anyone know the answer?
Well, that sounds like the Leventhal
paradox. Yes, that's the Leventhal paradox. But you get the age of the universe, so it doesn't make... if you don't... No, but you need... Yes, but if you don't have a driving force, if you just look for... you, if you just sample randomly, then it will take you forever.
It's 2 to n, where n is number of...
Yeah, not 2, but it's the number of conformation per monomer. So it's an astronomical number. It doesn't make... You need a driving force, because if it's purely diffusive... And then, in order to know,
a slightly different question. Just the sort of relaxation time for a compact object without the barriers, just doing a random walk.
But you don't do a random walk because everything is stuck together.
You have barriers even in the homopolymer, right?
Yes, in the homopolymer, you ask what would be.
Then you think, but there's no glassiness. How long does it take for such a relaxation time for such an object?
It's some power of the.
It's presumably it's power law.
Power of n.
It goes. Yeah, it's.
This one is exponential.
No, it's power of n and the power of n.
How do you know it's
okay? No, I tell you. No, I don't know. What I can tell you is, if you take a dense polymer solution, the relaxation time of a piece of polymer inside goes like n cube. Actually, it's n to the power 3.2, or yeah, it's called reptation. And
that's already
typing
number.
Yes, but for n
the power cube.
Yes, but the time step with the time scale, which is yes, but you see this time scale with n cube give times of order of seconds for polymer of size 10^5. And there is a n cube or something like that. So if you scale it back, you see that it's very small times.
As far as I know, there's no experimental attempts to
experimental to what?
Well, for example, to look how the relaxation time scaling the length of the chain.
No, there is. No, there is hundreds. Actually, there is. Of course, there is. No.
So this
is
does it go like an exponential?
No, not at all. And the surprising thing is that certain proteins, the time, the folding time is faster for longer proteins. So it doesn't scale with n at all. Actually, there is experiments by David Baker, who is going to be here, which show that the thing which counts is not the length of the protein, but rather, so it's Baker and Plaxico. Plaxico is here in the chemistry department, which show that there is a number which is called the average contact number, average contact order, which is L over N. So L is the distance between two residues in contact. Okay? So you average that, you look at all the contacts in the protein, and you take the average and you divide by the length of the protein. And then you plot, you do a log-log plot of the folding rate as a function of C. And you find a very nice straight line where all the points go like this, which means this plot tells you that for fixed contact order, when n is larger, the protein folds faster, which is an experimental fact. There are some proteins which, when they are longer, fold faster, which is contradictory with what you would have in polymer physics, where all the time scales scale with n.
If you believe that folding just changes to base on pathways, then not only will have paradox, but I guess overall of metastable states is probably far less.
Yes, sure. But then the question is to explain why you have only one pathway.
But that would make it point of view very different from
yes.
The physics of glass.
Yes, of course.
The number of contacts are measured in the finally folding state.
In the crystal structure.
In the
structure which has been resolved crystallographically. So you have, you know exactly which residue is close to which residue. So you can measure the contact. Yes, exactly. Yes, you give a contact, cut off 4, 5, 6 angstrom and so. Yes?
Is the
folding rate. Folding rate, so it's the number of folding events per second. And actually it's a log-log plot. Sorry?
Inverse folding time.
Yeah, inverse folding time, exactly.
Does the distribution of L have any nice behavior?
Sorry?
Does the distribution of L?
Oh, people didn't look. To be honest, I have to say that this law seems to hold only for what's called two-state proteins. So two-state proteins is a large class of proteins, but it's proteins which fold in a specific way. But it's really a large class of proteins. And apparently, if you try to introduce more detail, because they have played around with trying to improve that, whatever you do to improve it, that's what they write in the paper, and that's what they say when you talk with them, whatever you do to improve it, it gets worse. So that's the best.
So total contact length, every contact you add a number?
Yes, no, you average. L is the average distance along the chain between two residues which come close together.
And
that's the N is the total number of monomers in the chain. I mean, it can go out of the and doesn't depend on the...
Why is this difference between typical polymers and proteins?
Because in typical polymers, the collapse time, for instance, will scale with n, with the size of the polymer.
Right.
It will increase. In the typical polymer, for instance, you will see that the folding time, or not folding time, but the collapse time, scales like n to some power lambda.
Do we understand why that is?
Yes, of course. That this, if you do just, you take a Langevin equation, you solve the Langevin equation for the dynamics of the polymer, and you necessarily find that it goes like this because it's a diffusive process. So the exponent is not trivial to calculate, but you...
Right. But why isn't this law not followed by proteins? That's what I don't get. Because is a polymer.
Yes, but... But not all polymers are equal.
Not most.
So for homopolymers...
Yes, this is homopolymer.
Okay, that's
so proteins have specific... it's a heteropolymer, I forgot to say it, but of course...
Yeah, but proteins have also been evolved to fold relatively quickly too. So
maybe,
you add in a whole
maybe.
New beast, and it's not just polymer physics anymore.
No.
Excuse me.
Proteins have been evolved, so it's not just polymer physics anymore. There's also this.
In the case of polymer, you can scale a large interval of n.
Yes.
Experimentally, for proteins, you scale only three times. There's
yes.
No three order
yes.
Of magnitude.
Yes. Of course. Of course.
Times.
Yes. Yes, at most.
The structure of protein is much more important.
Yes, but you don't see a trend, something like. I mean, it's difficult.
This
is a very complicated polymer.
Yes, but the longer protein. Well,
the average.
You can have
the average, but between proteins of the same length.
Yes, exactly. Yes, if you take protein of a given length, you would see a whole range of several order of magnitudes of folding times. Yes. This is absolutely correct. So some questions that physicists can ask is about the nature of the folding transition. Is it a crystallization, glass, or is it just a funnel where there is a single minimum and it crystallizes? Is it purely dynamical? There is an interesting question about the uniqueness of the native state. I didn't talk yet about secondary structures. I will talk about secondary structures. And there are questions about the kinetics or the dynamics. How does it go? Is there intermediate states? How many, etc.? There are also questions of protein design, which will be discussed in one of the weeks. So protein design is how do you design a protein which will have a given function or improve the function of a protein by doing specific mutations so that, for instance, it can bind better to other objects. And there are many interesting problems. So a characteristic of proteins is the existence of local order. And this is called secondary structures. So in proteins, if you look at the crystallized protein, the native state, there are essentially two motifs which are seen very often. One is the so-called alpha helix, which is right-handed. It's chiral, it's right-handed. And it's right-handed because the amino acids are left-handed. And these alpha helices are presumably stabilized by hydrogen bonds, and the hydrogen bonds go between the CO. Here on the backbone there is a CO, and here there is a NH. So you have CO, NH, which align and make a hydrogen bond. There is 3.6 amino acid per turn, and the typical helix is about 5 to 7 turns. The other structure which is seen quite often, which is typical, is the beta sheet, where the backbone goes like this. And again, you have CO, NH, which make hydrogen bonds. So it can be anti-parallel or parallel, where it goes like this, it comes back, and the hydrogen bond is not done between these guys, but between this one and this one, in the same direction. So it doesn't matter, it's a detail. And so this is the same hemoglobin as before. It's a seven helix bundle. So this is a representation of the backbone. And this is a protein which is a, it's a venom of an insect. And you see a lot of alpha helices, a lot of beta sheets. So the beta sheets are represented like this. And so in this part there are beta sheets. Here you have the helices. And that's it. So this is the secondary structure. And then, of course, the 3D structure of the folded protein is the compact packing of secondary structures as it was in RNA folding, as we saw before. So how can one measure the folding, or can one see the folding transition? So if you want to do a very gross or a very non-too detailed experiments, you can measure the radius of gyration. And to measure the radius of gyration, you can do it either by X-ray, by SACS, or by neutron scattering. And this is techniques which are used in polymer physics, where you can just measure radius of gyration. And of course, the radius of gyration in the denatured state and in the native state is not the same. So you can see, you can follow the folding transition by looking at the biological activity. So in the unfolded state, there is no biological activity. And so you just monitor the biological activity. NMR, which allows you to measure nearby hydrogen atom, tells you in which state the system is, whether it's folded or unfolded. And because of the secondary structures which are present in the protein, there is a the proteins are optically active, and therefore if you do circular dichroism in the UV, you will see, you can see the appearance of this secondary structure. And as I said before, the folding time is typically a second too. In order to see the 3D structure, you have, so the initial technique was X-ray crystallography. So the idea of X-ray crystallography is you make a crystal of protein. So what is a crystal of protein? It's a crystal and of protein. So all your supposedly native protein. No, because sometimes people ask what's... So it's just a crystal. At each vertex or each node of the crystal, you have a protein, presumably in the native state. So the state can be slightly modified, but and then you look at the diffraction pattern of that. So if you look at the diffraction pattern of that, you will see the diffraction pattern of the lattice convoluted by the diffraction pattern of each of these small objects. And from that, of course, you measure some diffraction intensity in the various direction. And from that, there is a difficult problem, of course, which is the phase ambiguity, because you measure the square of the Fourier transform e to the IQR of the density, let's say. So you measure that, and by measuring that, you want to measure the density, essentially the electronic density of the protein. So there are techniques for that.
Yeah, but the local orientation of the protein.
Sorry?
The local orientation.
Yes.
Of the protein, although it's in the native state by slightly off, then the signal would be very blurry and you couldn't really determine.
Yes. So, you know, I brought my good friend who can tell you everything about protein crystallography. I never give a seminar without that.
So, no diffraction?
Yeah, so that's a bad crystal and you remain a crystal.
Yeah, this is not a crystal.
Yeah. If it's a crystal, in principle, you have a... And since... more recently, there have been... So this method is, of course, an excellent method, except that people don't know how to make crystals of proteins. It's apparently, it's an art. And
trial and error.
So it's not an art.
That is enough.
The point is that, of course, if you know how to make one protein, usually you can crystallize several homologous proteins. That's why if you look in the database, so if you can crystallize human hemoglobin, then you can crystallize mouse hemoglobin, horse hemoglobin, etc.
Roughly half the proteins live in the membrane, and those you cannot crystallize.
So you can, of course, there are but like 5 or 10 proteins which are crystallized, of course.
Membrane proteins, that's kind of difficult.
There is a Nobel Prize, Dysonhofer, Muller.
You use detergent.
You crystallize with the membrane in detergent. And then they have resolved the bacterial rhodopsin, and this family of proteins have been resolved, and there are, I think, 12 or which have been resolved.
About 10.
Of the order of 10. And the proteins which live in the PDB, the protein data bank, is about 15,000. It doesn't mean that it's 13 or 15,000 different structures, because they group by homology. So the number of homologous of different classes of proteins is about 600 to 700.
That's the known one.
Yes, the crystallized, the resolved structures.
Right.
600 to 700 different folds.
The projection of how many will be a saturation of that?
Yeah, on the order of several thousand.
Several thousand?
Yes. So there is still some work to do. So how do the chemists look at this problem? They, chemists and biochemists and so they look for, they try to make microscopic models based on microscopic Hamiltonians. So they try to invent empirical or semi-empirical Hamiltonian, and which will describe the atomic atom-atom interactions. And then once they have this Hamiltonian, then in principle what you have to do is molecular dynamics, Monte Carlo, whatever you want, Langevin equation. So what are the interactions which are present in a protein? So there are two types of interactions. You have bonded. So of course, it depends at which scale you ask. Eventually, everything is Coulomb, as we know from this morning. But if you start from Coulomb, it's difficult. So people prefer to introduce two kinds of interactions. So there are bonded interactions, and bonded interactions are essentially the interactions which make up the covalent bond and which make up the backbone and the structure of the protein. And there is another one which is called the sulfur bridge, but which is a covalent bond between sulfur atoms of two different residues. Otherwise, residues interact together by Coulomb interaction with partial charges. So they assign a partial charge, which is an effective charge, which is usually smaller than 1, 0.2, 0.3, to some atoms. There is a van der Waals interaction. Yes, there is a van der Waals interaction which mimics the steric repulsion. And then the hydrogen bonds between which I talked about before. So they can be either in certain models of interactions they are present or they are not present. It depends on the model. And the solvent, which is water, in principle proteins fold in water. And so the solvent, if you make a simulation, you should also simulate the water, or at least take care of the water, which is polar, because it's believed that, after all, it's the water which, by the hydrophobic interactions, will induce the collapse and eventually the folding of the protein. So the shape of the Hamiltonian, which is used in many programs or many parameterization, is the following. There is an elastic term to mimic the covalent bond, and in some cases they just you take this to be frozen to a fixed length B0. That's one of the hard degrees of freedom. The valence angles are also described by harmonic harmonic vibrations, if you want, a harmonic term. This improper dihedral, which is the vibration of this bond with respect to this plane, is also taken like this. So these 3 degrees of freedom are very hard, and in many cases one can just freeze them to the value beta 0, theta 0, nu 0. Then there is this dihedral angles, which is this torsional degrees of freedom, and this is very small, and in many models these k's are essentially 0. So this describes the rotation of sections of the chain. And then these are the so-called non-bonded interactions. So this is the Coulomb interaction. So I was asked, what is this? This is 332, is the 1 over 4 pi epsilon 0 in units of kilocalorie per, when the energies are... So the standard energy scale is kilocalorie per mole, and epsilon is the effective... So let me give some energy scales. 4. Good question. Depends on the unit. So the energy scales are here. 1 electron volt is 23 kilocalorie per mole, 10,000 degrees. So room temperature in kilocalorie per mole is 0.6. So it's typically 1 kilocalorie per mole. Covalent bond is 50 to 150 kilocalorie per mole, and therefore it's many KTs, 100 KTs, something like that. Sulfur bridge is the same category. Now the weak interactions, you have hydrogen bonds, so in a polar solvent it's 1 to 2 kilocalorie per mole. In a non-polar solvent, of course, it's a little bit bigger. Now, the van der Waals interactions which come in, which are represented by Lennard-Jones 612 potential, are of the order of 1 kilocalorie per mole, and this is also, the Coulomb is also, plays the role of 1 of 2 kilocalorie per mole. So essentially everything is, if you freeze these interactions here, everything is governed by these terms. And then once you have that, depending on your taste, with this Hamiltonian, you write a code which can be very large. And you can either do molecular dynamics with Newton or Langevin, or you can do Monte Carlo. But basically what you do is you write some kind of stochastic equation with the noise, for instance, if it's Langevin. And then you just solve it, you iterate. And you know that, for instance, if you take the case of Langevin, if you wait long enough, eventually you should relax to a Boltzmann distribution. Now the point is, of course, the time scales that I showed before, that if you wait long enough, it can be very long. The discretization time step is typically femtoseconds or hundreds of, you can, by using some acceleration technique, you can go to 10 to the minus 13 seconds. And if you take small proteins with, let's say, 1,000 atoms, if you put in water, the longest available runs will be typically 10 to the minus 8 seconds. And the times that one can usually solve this equation, during which one can solve this equation, is up to now, at least, no single event relevant to protein folding was ever seen in this molecular dynamics simulation. Yes?
Is it possible just to throw away the inertia?
Yes, of course, of course.
And then the time scale can be much longer than...
So Seb Doniak has tried that, but he was not able to fold. Okay, if you... I must say maybe one comment about the potential. The potentials which are here have been designed not for folding, but the parameters of these potentials have been fitted usually on small molecules like alkanes, alcenes, whatever. And they have been fitted also on the vibrations of proteins. So nobody knows really if these potentials are good enough to fold proteins. In other words, if you if you take this crystalline structure of a protein, you put it in, you don't know if what you get, if this potential doesn't have a, and actually there are evidences with certain potentials that there are structures which have not, the non-native structures which have lower energy than this one. So people don't, I don't know if people really, yes?
Do people have unfolded structures to check you?
To check the stability, yes,
yeah.
Yes. What you can
find for this potential.
Well, they are not stable usually. No, what happens? No, but look, no, it's these potentials can be used for what's called structure refinement. People who do X-ray crystallography, what they do when you do your X-ray measurement, so you come out with coordinates of the atom. And so if I draw this picture, which is not the free energy, actually it's the energy. So let's say you are here. So the claim is that for whatever reasonable, geometrically reasonable structure, which is compact of a protein, nearby there will be a metastable state of the protein. So if you take any compact structure of a protein, it's any compact state is close to a metastable state of the real protein. Yes?
Is it well established if one needs to take into account carefully the entropy, or is it purely an energetic
problem? It's apparently purely an energetic. That's what people believe. What kind of, it depends what you mean by entropy, of course. You mean the conformational entropy or the vibrational?
Vibrational entropy.
Okay, vibrational entropy that can help to find but conformational entropy, people believe that from that point of view it's at, it's frozen. Of course, okay. But essentially what people do when they, in order to do what they call refine structures, so they start from here with this kind of potential and they look for the closest local minimum. And therefore if you look at the in the PDB, you have sometimes two files of the same protein, one, or in the same file, you will have the structure of the X-ray and you have the refined structure also. You wanted to?
I want to add that X-ray gives you, so to say, general attribution of atoms. You know that this atom must be approximately here, this atom must be approximately here. And this, when you start from this, make artificial bounds to this scene position, then you refine as I'm told. If you don't, if you forget about these artificial strings, you go away from the structure which you see indeed. So from experimental structure. If you just rely on energy functions, you go approximately, usually, two extremes away from the structure which you see, which is seen by X-ray or NMR. This is an evidence that the potentials are very, very rough, very good.
What's to extra from NMR?
To the RMSD, yes, per atom. Per atom.
Each atom goes to extra away from its position which is observed.
It does a little answer to something, don't find it.
No, no. Well, you have no time to fall apart. This is not as funny. When people unfold, they put 600 degrees.
Yes.
And then it falls apart in 10 nanoseconds.
Yes.
But the experimental accuracy in the X-ray experiment is also about 2 angstroms.
Excuse me?
The accuracy of the experiments.
1.5, 1.6.
1.5, 2 angstroms.
Yes. Yes, but this is thermal fluctuation. Yes. No, but there are cases. Yes, no, there are cases which are known with these potentials where you can find structures which are non-native and which have lower energy than the native structures. Which means that they are not good. But then how do you improve? Maybe you'll talk about that. No?
Okay. Maybe I could make a comment. It's true that if you try to sort of relax the crystallographic structure using this potential, some of the atoms are going to go away, but it's going to be mainly the loops, the X area of the protein, and inside the core remains practically constant.
because it has nowhere to move.
I mean, if you run this experiment long enough, I'm not
totally aware of the latest developments of the potentials for molecular dynamics people, but I think that they have more or less potential nowadays that keep the protein stable for at least their length of simulation.
No. If you just see the paper, they do some track and yes. At low temperature, which displaced by 2 angstrom. And they say this will be our data structure, we will discuss everything is compared with this, not with PDB data, but with another structure, which is close, of course.
Maybe there will be somebody who will talk
to us. I don't know. I haven't seen the titles of the talks. So.
Here, so in this model, you are treating each amino acid as a particle.
No. So here it's all atoms.
All atoms.
Yes. It's all atoms. It's a very detailed model. The codes are huge. I mean, it's because there is a lot of geometry, a lot of.
I keep on hearing people say, "What is the problem? Can you give us a sense of how carefully you have to treat water to get these things?"
Yeah, that's
good.
Well, water. Well, what is known is that if you take a protein and if you try to fold it in the vacuum, some may fold, but usually not in the same structure as it will have in water. So apparently water is determinant. So water, you have small dipoles, small charges, and so, of course, you can view a protein is trying to optimize, let's say, its hydrophobic surface by minimizing its hydrophobic surface. So if you don't have the water, then you don't have this hydrophobic effect. So there is that. There is also the fact that the external monomers, the external amino acids, make hydrogen bonds with the water. So there is a strong orientation of the hydration layer around the protein. And all these effects are necessary if you want to fold the protein.
But they are not in this energy.
No, they are, of course, because the water.
Epsilon.
No, but okay.
The molecule is explicitly.
You can put water. When people put.
This energy function, the one that you had on.
Yes. Sorry, it's here, so you don't see. So in this energy function, of course, you have some kind of effective epsilon. Yes, but this effective epsilon, of course, look, the charges are also effective charges. You don't believe that the atoms have a charge 1/3. So everything is effective. Actually, the epsilon is taken, some people take an epsilon which depends on R inside the protein. Some people take epsilon of order 4 and 5 inside the protein and 80 outside. But in principle, for instance, if you treat the water explicitly, yeah, outside, you should take one and just treat the dipoles.
But this dynamics will be ready about 20 weeks at least to fold, at least in the ground state. Right?
Yes.
Then you can see a folding in the ground state and in the water, but if you just.
I've heard people say that there's so much we don't understand about water that it's impossible to fold protein. I mean, this is an extreme view, but they.
Some explicitly put water molecules in, right? So they take the same.
Yes. They say usually they have even different kind. Actually, the potentials for water can be much more precise because there have been, because water it's only one molecule. So people have been working for years and years to develop potentials for water. They are quite accurate and they give you. Quite good results in molecular dynamics, and so they use this kind of potentials, but then you need a lot of water molecule because a protein is quite big. It's like 40, 50 angstrom.
So basically, to summarize, what you are saying is that they use a method which can run at best 8 orders of magnitude too short.
But there is this
function which they don't know.
Exactly. No, to reach a conclusion which, if it is wrong, they won't know whether they didn't run it long enough.
There's some other state of it.
Or whether the potentials are wrong. But of course, there are many people who claim that they solve the problem. No, but not in these ways. So I don't know. Maybe do I make a? I have a lot of other things to say. So I, okay. Ah yes. No, T is. Okay. So I will. Okay. So we'll make a break at the T. So I will discuss the simplest model that one can imagine to, which is a model, in fact, for the collapse of a polymer, and so many people know that it's the famous theta point. And one could think, and actually it was believed in the beginning, that this would be a good model for protein folding. So what is the model? So the idea is that if you have a protein, typically in a protein you have half of the monomers are hydrophilic, half of the monomers are hydrophobic, and therefore on the average you have a strong, and the hydrophobic monomers are all over the place. So essentially when you put it in water at low enough temperature, it will just collapse and try to avoid the contact with water. So the simplest model that was introduced in this context is the model which is used in polymer physics to describe the behavior of a polymer in a bad solvent. Water, you assume, so what you do is you first of all, it's a very coarse grained model where each amino acid is represented by a single segment. And then you assume that all residues are identical on the average and that they're all on the average hydrophobic. So you take a chain of hydrophobic monomers. So because the solvent is hydrophobic, it means that the water will induce an attraction between the monomers, because the monomers want to be close together and to be compact in order to avoid contact with the water. So the interaction which you can take, but this is not crucial, can be a Lennard-Jones 612. So this problem was studied by Flory in the context of polymer in a bad solvent, but it's also Lifshitz, many people looked at this problem. And the typical problem, the potential that one can use is attractive and repulsive at short distance. And then you're supposed to calculate the partition function for this model. And the results are well known. And let me see. Okay, so the results are well known. There is a competition between the entropy in the... So the polymer can exist in two phases, essentially. A swollen phase, where the polymer is swollen, and the collapsed phase, where it is collapsed. And in the swollen phase, the interactions essentially play no role. What is dominant is the entropy of the system, because it's swollen. In the collapse phase, the entropy is smaller than in a swollen phase, but then you gain energy from the collapse. So these two phases are characterized by the size of the radius of gyration. So in this phase, the polymer coil is large, and its scales, the size of the coil goes like n to the nu, where the exponent nu is approximately the Flory exponent 3/5, which we heard about yesterday. It's 0.588. And then there is a critical temperature theta. Below theta, the system goes into a collapse phase. The polymer shrinks and is completely collapsed. And in this phase, the radius of gyration still goes like n to the nu. It scales with the size of the chain, but with an exponent nu, which is 1/3. And 1/3 is, of course, the exponent of a completely compact chain. The two phases are separated by a transition point, which is a theta point. And in 3D, at the theta point, the radius of gyration scales with an exponent nu, which is essentially 1/2. And the theta point for proteins is 6 molar urea. Molar urea. Okay. So the theta transition is a tricritical point. Okay. And of course, this model is too rough to represent the. It's much too rough to represent the folding transition and the folded state. One of the reasons is, of course, that in the collapsed phase, there is a finite entropy. And actually, there is an exponential so in the swollen phase, the number of conformations of the polymer scales as a certain number, which is, grossly speaking, Q minus 1. In fact, it's smaller, times to the power n. So if it was a Brownian chain, it would be, let's say, in 3D, it would be 6 to the n if you on a cube. So here, it's a number which depends on the lattice or on the model to the power n times n to some exponent gamma minus 1. In the collapsed phase,
what is gamma?
Gamma is an exponent, is the exponent of, it's the correction to the, so if you count the number of conformations of self-avoiding walk, there is an entropy, if you want, an entropy term which is exponential in n, and then the first correction is given by this, and what is, of course, the thing is that gamma, this exponent gamma, is universal. It's independent.
Small.
Sorry?
And small.
It's 1.2, 1.2. So this correction, 1.2 or so, minus 1, is small. In mean field, it's gamma equals 1. Now, in the collapse phase, the number of conformation also is exponentially large. And after the break, I will come to that. So it goes like GC, C for compact, or collapsed, I don't remember, to the n, times n to the gamma minus 1. So the gamma, it's a different gamma, it's a different constant. But this constant, the number of conformation, is smaller than this one. It's typically of order Q over E. So on a 3D cubic lattice, for instance, the constant here is 4.2, whereas here it's 2.2. So you see that there is a huge decrease in the entropy, but still you have an extensive number, extensive entropy, which means that there is an exponential number of compact states. I will come back to that after the break. Also, of course, in this model there is no such thing as a secondary structure, and the theta transition is second order. It's a tricritical point. Whereas if you look at the denaturation curves for protein, it looks very much like a first-order transition. It's very sharp near the transition, and therefore this cannot be a good, very good model. So after the T, I will show you, for instance, how you can calculate these things in Hamiltonian walks by using techniques of field theory.
Please, yes. Add one word,
yes,
about,
please,
the transition. The second order transition, which you speak about, occurs at very low density of protein, of the chain.
Yes.
And the
folded, what do you mean?
The theta point,
yes,
corresponds to very low density of the chain.
Yes.
1n to the power of minus 1 second.
Yes.
And
when they don't, you mean when they don't see each other, when they're,
yeah, just where theta point occurs at very low density of the chain,
mm-hmm,
and the transition of protein occurs, but density is close to 100%.
You mean in a cell?
No.
What do you call density?
Density.
Explain.
Okay.
Occupied volume. So nearly all the volume.
You're talking about many molecules.
One molecule of protein. When you decay, when this protein melts, it has high density.
Of course, yes.
Density.
It's compact, you mean?
Yeah.
The protein is compact.
I mean that the transition takes place at very different densities, not only different order, but very different points.
It depends what you call transition. I mean, if you do that experiment, for instance, you start in 6 molar urea, mm-hmm, and you inject water.
Mm-hmm.
So at 6 molar urea, the protein is completely unfolded. It's
unfolded.
And then you remove the urea by dissolving water very fast, and then you'll see the protein collapse. And then it will go to a high concentration.
At low density. You don't see something like native protein with low density.
No, sure, they are compact.
Yes.
If that's what you mean.
Okay.
Okay, so I will...
Let's meet again in 15 minutes. For this nice rest that you have, I'm showing you how to count Hamiltonian path, because it's an interesting combinatorial problem, and which is quite useful, because as you will see later in the weeks, for those who will be here, people who do protein do a lot of lattice models, and therefore it's good to know how many paths you have. So, what is a Hamiltonian path? You have a lattice, and a Hamiltonian path is essentially a compact, it's a self-avoiding walk on the lattice which goes to each point of the lattice once and only once. So it's a self-avoiding walk which covers completely the lattice. And the first question on the self-avoiding path, on the Hamiltonian path, you have a Hamiltonian path on the lattice, how do you count them? So, in order to count them, you can use a trick from
Excuse me, who defines which part of lattice I'm supposed to count?
So you have a finite lattice.
And I have polynomial of the same length.
Sorry? They are all, if you cover the lattice, if you have a chain of length n,
yeah,
and you have n points, okay, you cover
okay.
Each point is...
Then there is no decision, no tab decision.
No. So this is how it goes, and this is some work that we did like 15 years ago. So maybe I need some of that. So the idea is the following: if you have a lattice, a square, take a square lattice, but it works in a bending lattice. So at each side of the lattice, so what is a Hamiltonian path? I don't know if I have a drawing. Okay. So at each side of the lattice, I will put a field, two fields actually. So this is an arc at each side of the lattice. So I will consider an integral like this. And product over r, I r squared, which is basically what I wrote. So what it means, at each point of the lattice, I introduce a field, phi r, and I introduce a phi r squared over 2. So I introduce two fields, and the factor 2 is just from the symmetry factor. And delta is the nearest neighbor of the operator, which connects nearest neighbors on the lattice. So delta r r prime equals 1 if r minus r prime equals 1 and 0 otherwise. So if I look at this object, it's a Gaussian integral, a Gaussian wave. So that it, and of course it can be normalized by a certain normalization. So if I calculate this functional integral, it tells me that I should cut, according to the weak theorem, I should contract any line which is here with any other line, with any other phi r, with a propagator which is delta r r prime. So I have phi r prime equals delta r r prime. So since this delta is a nearest neighbor operator, it means that I can connect together only lines which are nearest neighbor. So I can connect, for instance, this one to this one, and this one I can connect to this one, etc. And by doing that, of course, you can see that since at each point there is, and it's the sum of all completely connected contractions, sets of contractions. So if I do that, essentially what I will have, I will construct walks which cover completely the whole lattice. Now, of course, there is nothing in this expansion, in this approach, which controls the number of connected parts of the lattice. So I can have as many connected parts as I want. So this is well known what to do in that case. What you have to do is, instead of taking a scalar field, you take a vector field, which has n components, and you put like this, and the vector field being such that it's an O(n) field with n components. So if I have n components, essentially I have phi r alpha, phi r prime beta. If I try to contract two different components, this is delta alpha beta, because this is the diagonal propagator, times delta r prime. And then you can see that if I look at the contractions of these, I will have exactly the same topology of graphs, namely I will have to make polynomial polygons which cover the whole space, but each polygon will have a cover, will have a running index, because the index alpha is concerned on a line, and each vertex has, at each point I have alpha alpha. So it means that there is an index alpha which is running over all closed loops. And therefore, there is a factor, a counting factor, which is n to the power number of connected pieces of the diagram. And therefore, if I want to count only single loops, which are Hamiltonian, which they are given by, so the single loops are given by 1 over n, and you take then the limit n to 0. For this, in theory, in the right, was it 0 or is it okay? Actually, if you want to, so this is for completely compact walls. If you want to study not only compact walls, but you can study walls where you assign a certain fugacity k to each bond. So if you assign a fugacity k to each bond instead of this product, what we do is product over r of 1 plus k phi r square over 2. Now this k phi r square over 2, in that case, it means that the side would be, so at each side r, you can choose either that the sides be empty, or it will be passed by two lines, and then you have a weight k. So k is essentially the chemical potential, the fugacity of the bond. So essentially this formula, this is n, written like this, if I take, can be, it's just the partition function of a set of a polymer where the fugacity of the monomer is given by k. And actually, so now you can use this formulation to study self-avoiding walks if you work at a finite k, if you adjust the k in such a way that the length is just divergent. And if you take the limit k going to infinity, then you get a Hamiltonian path and self-avoiding walks. So once you have a formulation like this, what you do is you can do a loop expansion. And what you essentially have is, so in order to do the loop expansion, you write it as p to the minus 1 half phi r delta r prime minus phi r prime. Let's say if I do it for set of a more plus sum over r log phi r square. And you look for the minimization, and then you can expand. So the result is very simple.
Could you explain, how do you take limit when n goes to 0 when n is an integer?
Okay, if you calculate this quantity, for instance, okay, if you do it perturbatively, namely, well, essentially, if you do any calculation at any order with any method, it will depend on n.
Yes, but and then isn't your n here an integer?
Yes, but on the final expression, the n, you don't know that it's an integer.
It's defined for every integer n, so you analytically continue it for continuous
okay,
n.
Okay, so just a second, because you can do that.
Yeah.
Yes. There is some condition, so the conditions are called.
It works.
Yes.
If it doesn't work, then it's going to have some problem.
No, but this is a case where it works. Okay. It's Kalson theorem. So Kalson theorem states that if you have a function of n, which for n large
grows slower than an exponential in n,
pick the function zn. If zn grows slower than e to the alpha n, where n goes to infinity over u, then the analytic continuation at n equals 0 is unique. So if it is unique, you just have to put n equals 0 and that's it. So that's a nice case. In the case of spin glasses, you can show that the zn.
So when does this term hold?
Sorry?
Could you give reference to this term?
It's called Carlson theorem. And I think it's from the 1920s.
Where can you find this?
Complex analysis. And there are other conditions. But okay, this is the weakest form of the theorem, and that form. So for that case, you can show, I don't know how, but then. But I know that in the primary case, you can show that the analytic continuation is unique. And you can show for spin glasses that it is not, because the function grows as e to the n squared. Okay. Doesn't mean that it's real.
Does that imply that it is not? Or
sorry?
Does that imply that it is not, or just say that it is not guaranteed?
No, it doesn't imply that there, yeah. there is just no unicity of the analytic continuation. So setting n equals 0 on the final result.
Because you can add sine n.
Exactly. You have the problem with sine pi n, which vanishes at each integer, and which, if you are off the real axis, will grow in infinity. So if you forbid this sine pi n, then you have a unique pair.
Yeah, it seems that if you do that, one of the n goes 0, you actually have all the closed loops. And it's not necessarily the one that, that one path actually traverse every single last point.
Which one? Please?
No, I mean you do take that limit. Yeah, actually, as long as the loop actually closes itself, and then those
because
the collection of those.
No, you have a factor of n for each closed loop. Each closed loop will have a factor of n because you have the field which is the.
Oh, right.
So
this is
only the one
for
other n, which means the. Okay, so if you do this loop expansion, so then what I mean by loop expansion is not these loops. It's a generic term, which is the saddle point method or the method on this integral. So you loop for the field on which.
Excuse me, what is loop at the lattice?
Sorry?
Can you explain? What is loop at the lattice?
It's a closed polygon loop. That's what I mean by loop.
Well, chain?
Yes, it's a chain. So it's like a chain on the left. You know, people who do, you've seen 100 times, these people doing these lattice simulations for protein, right? So what do? They enumerate all compact walks on the lattice.
Yes.
So that's a compact walk. It goes through each point of the lattice once and only once. It doesn't cross itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it occupies all the sides.
And this is loop.
It's loop if you close it.
Uh-huh.
In principle, if it's a path, it can start here, do whatever you want, and then end here.
Yes.
So if I want to enumerate that, I would need an additional source term here. Because of this n equals 0, I need a source, so I would need a phi at some point 0 and a phi at some point r. Mm-hmm. This would be the starting point of the loop, and this would be the end point.
Okay.
But to simplify, if I'm just doing counting, I expect the counting not to depend very much on the fact that
the n is very big.
Yeah. Yes. So
this is capital N, not small N.
Capital N, small N, and loop expansion. Okay. So the result of this is that to one loop order, the partition function, the number, so Z is the total number of Hamiltonian walks, and it is the result that I showed you before. It's equal to Q over E, so Q is the coordination number of the lattice. So the coordination number of the lattice is q, which for a d-dimensional cubic lattice would be 2 × 10⁶. So this is the result to mean field plus first order correction. And what's nice is that the first order correction is identically zero. And the reason why the first order correction is identically zero is when you, so in order to get the one root correction, you do the, you calculate the determinant of population. So when you do your mean field, you have a phi r, which is a vector, so you break the symmetry, you choose one direction, and you take a phi, which will be like this, in one of the n directions, and zero everywhere else. Now, when you want to calculate fluctuations, you will take a delta phi, and you will have a phi plus phi plus delta phi transverse, and you will have a delta phi longitudinal. And so you will have a determinant of transverse and of longitudinal. So there are n minus 1 like this, and 1 like this. So when you do the fluctuation determinant, you will have e to the minus 1 half trace log of a certain matrix G T corresponding to this. And then you have e to the minus n minus 1 over 2 trace log G longitudinal. This is for the one mode, for the one transverse mode, and this is for the n minus 1
longitudinal. How do I neglect?
If you switched longitudinal and transverse.
Yes, yes.
Do that?
Longitudinal basic is 1, transverse is n minus 1.
Yeah, sorry, sorry. No, it's just to confuse a little bit more, right? So it turns out that, so when the n goes to 0, you just, so that's an example, n goes to 0, you put n equals 0 here. So you have the ratio of the determinant, the trace log GL by trace log GT. It turns out that if you are on the bipartite lattice, bipartite lattice I can explain, but the cubic lattice is bipartite. So if you are on the bipartite lattice, there is a symmetry which makes that this determinant, these two operator are equal. And therefore there is an exact cancellation of the two fluctuations. And therefore the only correction is next order. And some people have calculated this correction. So it's q over 2 times. So the partition, the set is of the form g to the n with g equal q over e times 1 plus 1 over 6 to the square. So it's a very, for if you're in 3D on the cubic lattice in 3D, this is 1 over 216, which is quite small compared to that. And actually, so this is a very simple formula. If the lattice is a bipartite lattice, is a lattice which you can color with two different colors without having with alternate, without having twice the same color, the same color. And it's a lattice where you can have antiferromagnetic.
All the neighbors of one color are from the other.
Exactly. Right. So if you have that, then that's. So on the square lattice, so there have been numerical simulations for that. And on the square lattice, q equals 4, so q over e is 1.4715. And the best numerics available are due to Bernard Derrida, who's in transfer matrix, and he gets 1.472. Yes. And on the honeycomb lattice in 2D, which corresponds to q equals 3, it can be solved exactly by Bethe ansatz. And in that case, the exact result is 1.06, and this approximation gives 1.1. And the miracle, as I point out, is that the quadratic fluctuation vanishes identically, which means that the next correction is of order 1 over q squared instead of 1 over q. And that's pretty small. Okay, so that was one thing. Now I want to go maybe to heteropolygon models.
But okay, for proteins, if you want to apply this, you think probably about 3D imaginal lattices.
Yes.
So then this thing is not that small. I mean, this quantity Q is not that
six.
Small. Yeah, so
Q
six
is
over E, it's two.
It's, well, it's 1/216, so it's really.
No, Q over E.
Yes, Q over E is large.
Like two, yeah?
It's 2.4.
Yeah. So it's a huge entropy.
Yes, it's a huge entropy, but much smaller than the for a self-evaluating. So Q
two times smaller number than for,
yes,
for self-avoiding, right?
Exactly. For self-avoiding, Q for self for not Q but let's say G for self-avoiding work is 4.2.
Yes.
So it's about almost double. Yeah. So it's a huge.
So it's a simple thing to remember.
Yes.
It's like
actually this result.
Why smaller than for self-avoiding?
Yes. Q over E is virtually exact. It's not exact, of course, but for it's like the Flory theory for virtually most purposes.
So before the key, you finished with transparency, probably. It was tired, probably. And what are implications of this? Okay, so I am thinking about three-dimensional case. We agree that it's like 2 to n. So what are implications of this entropy?
Collapse.
Can you remind?
There is collapse. If you have attractive interactions, at high temperature, the chain is swollen because the entropy dominates the energy term.
Yeah.
And then when you decrease the temperature, the energy at some point, the energy that you gain by collapsing the chain will compensate the entropy that you lose, and the chain collapses.
I understand, but for this purpose, I don't need this entropy. This entropy...
You have to know that it's smaller.
Yeah. Smaller, so that two times we agreed it's like two times,
right?
2 to n, and this is entropy I lose.
That's the entropy you lose by collapse.
Okay,
and you have
so it's more quantitative than okay.
Yes.
Is there a power law prefactor or have one?
Okay. Yes. Though just to come back to that, it's not completely trivial that compact works have finite entropy.
Yeah, I didn't know this.
So, by the way, the correct way to prove that works in general go exponentially. So there is, you know, that if you do counting of works or counting of something, that it goes exponentially. The right way, or not the right way, but the way people do. And people are mathematicians, of course.
Video.
So you just have to show that one way to do it is to show that the number that you are looking at is bound above and below by something which looks like an exponential. So if you can show that when n is large you have this kind of bounds, then necessarily this n is exponential itself. So in the case of Hamiltonian walks, you can bound the Hamiltonian walks, the number of Hamiltonian walks, by the number of, let's say, Brownian walks, which is so cute, that which is exponentially n. And on this side, you have what's called Manhattan walks in 2D. So Manhattan walks in 2D. In Manhattan, you have streets, which are like this, and avenues, which are like this, and they alternate.
Okay.
One goes like this, one goes like that, and same with the streets.
Oh,
so you can look for compact walls on a Manhattan lattice. And this can be solved exactly in 2D, and it's an exponential number. Then from that, you can look at directed kind of Manhattan walks in a higher dimension, and you can show that it's also exponential. So you have these two bounds, which show that compact walls are indeed exponentially large.
And you indeed prove it for us before.
That's not the proof.
Okay. Show how you do it before.
All right, can tell you that it can be over.
Okay.
Yeah. For self-avoiding walks, it's a little bit different because for self-avoiding walks, you have one bound, which is easy, this one, which is a Brownian walk.
Yeah.
You have more Brownian walk than self-avoiding walk. And to get the other walk, you need to use what's called the self-additivity.
No, I don't understand this. I can use the old one, it will suffice too. for this purpose. It will not give me quantitative solution, but it will satisfy, and I can use your calculation too as a lower bound. So there are lots of.
I think this reflects more history than
that's
historically it was.
Yeah, historically, and you want a narrow window.
Yes, if you want.
If you want a really narrow window, then of course you have to think.
Okay, the pre-exponential. So in the case, of course, of the rank of the standard self-adjoint walk, this gamma minus one, if you can calculate in an epsilon expansion, it's a universal exponent, and it's well known, and we can calculate exactly in 2D, and in 4D you have an epsilon expansion. Now for the case of Hamiltonian walks, there are simulations in. Okay, so the loop expansion does not give you an exponent gamma. Now there are numerical simulations in 2D which seem to show, and there are several numerical simulations which seem to show that in 2D gamma equals 1. There is no correction.
We have exact results, but it's not one.
It's not balanced. I mean, you make it. Yeah. You can calculate it exactly. How much is it?
Depends on the bias.
Yes. it's not universal.
It's not universal. For square lattice, it's 117 over 112.
It's numerically one.
Oh no, numerically it's also not one because
but I thought
Lotte can do transfer matrix calculations,
yes,
which show that
it's not one.
It's not. But it's virtually one.
And how do you know how much it is in a higher density?
Equal
but actually, I would have thought, if you think a little bit naively, that the corrections to the, let's say, e to the alpha n, that's like a bulk term. So one possibility would be, of course, it's like a drop. So you expect a surface energy, which would be like delta n to the e minus 1 over t, so plus, etc. Like a surface tension term. But I guess most calculations are probably done with periodic boundary conditions.
So to be precise, that number is actually what would be the number that goes with the loop entropy. Slightly, well.
Yes.
If you want to define something that has any chance of being universal, it has to be somehow independent of the boundary conditions. So
yes.
So you want to take the ratio of partition functions.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, but you're right, that droplet picture works and there are numerics that have shown it.
So, for the moment, now I don't know what I should do. Should I continue on Hamiltonian walks and show what happens if you look at Hamiltonian walks with the bending rigidity, or should I go to heteropolynomial models?
Can you take a vote?
Probably more important you set up the heteropolymer.
Yeah.
Well, once we get going.
So what polymer?
The
democratically decide this question.
Yeah. So the simplest. Okay, this model that I showed before, which is the trivial theta collapse, doesn't take into account the sequence diversity of the polymer. So, in principle, we know there are 20 different types of amino acids, so you need 20 types of different monomers. Now, there is no known, and I think it was confirmed quite recently, specific arrangement of amino acids in the proteins that we can. From looking at the sequence, nobody can say whether it's a true protein, it's not a protein or so. And there is no short range, long range correlation, etc. So the simplest model that one can cook up with Randall is to assume that you have a random sequence of amino acids and a random quench sequence of amino acid, and therefore one has to study what's called quenched random heteropolymer models. So in principle, again, a protein is unique, so you should study a specific sequence of a protein. But of course, unless, yes.
But very strange, then how come when people do the gene finding, they use the hexamer, they use the, seems to have this. It seems like one amino acid source somehow is related to the next amino acid. Otherwise, I mean, the hexamer is completely useless. If a bunch of samples are true.
No.
Did you understand the question?
Sorry?
Did you understand the question?
I'm not sure. I think.
If you understood it, please explain it.
The correlation with amino acids, that's what he's saying.
Yeah. It's important. But
he's saying that there is some correlation.
Yeah, that people use that, you use that information actually in gene finding.
Okay, but there might be some correlation. But if I show anybody a sequence of amino acids starting with methionine and any of length, let's say 153, and I ask him, is it a protein or is it a random garbage? he will not be able to answer.
Right. Is that the relevant question?
No, but how come people answer this question with DNA?
Which codes for proteins.
Yeah. So how come they do?
Because DNA, you have a strong indication of the beginning of the sequence. No, what you see is that you can
identify. But there were correlations. People cut
the correlation is the correlation, which is trivial if you don't have it protein, of course.
Yeah,
so
but
you must have another correlation
beyond that.
You could have said.
Yes. But still.
Do you want to just fold the amino acids?
Yes, that's the relevant question. If you take a random 150 mer, will it fold?
Okay.
The answer is no.
No.
Well, the board is so
yeah,
20 to 150 possible random amino acids.
Yes.
And I think the fraction of those that will fold is zero. So, therefore, I think those sequences, whether you can or cannot, not by looking at them, determine that they are real or not, is irrelevant. Those sequences.
What
I'm saying, those that fold are a very substantial measure zero among the random ones.
Yes.
So if you do a calculation on random heteropolymers,
yeah.
it's a very nice exercise. I don't think it's relevant for protein.
Yes, yeah, so well, random heteropolymers go to the other.
It's as relevant as doing Langevin dynamics.
Yes, but we discussed
May I put this problem from different point of view? There are proteins which are water soluble globular proteins. You are speaking about them.
Yes.
There are membrane proteins.
Yes.
There are fibrous proteins.
Yes.
In fibrous proteins, you see very clear periodicity. In block in membrane proteins, you see blocks. So what you are speaking about, this random model, is attributed to water soluble. You talk without. So to say, we put it without explanation. And what you see in genes, for example, this can be taken from fibrous protein because you analyze huge masses of genes. And when people analyze sequences of normal for me is water soluble protein,
yeah.
They did not see pronounced correlations. There are statistical works of this kind. If people take all the pool of proteins all together, they see some correlations due to membrane proteins and first of all due to fibrous proteins. If they take water soluble, nothing reliable. So in this case, the best is to take simple model, this random model,
Let's see what happens.
Depends on purpose.
A starting point.
Just to add to a comment, I guess it was a question more. If you take a given family of a protein and then you just do the most stupid correlation function using, say, Blossom matrix as a score, then if you average over protein family, you do see the periodicity. Mm-hmm. But with that information is really quite weak. But the protein, the gene prediction people sort of put in whatever, it can't hurt, right? Whatever. But you do see the 3.5 periods and the up down and the beta shift a little bit.
So actually, if I knew of, okay, I'm going to present some random models where the variables, where the, let's say, the sequence is made of independent random variables. Now, if you tell me there is a certain correlation function, I'll be happy to put it in the averaging procedure.
Which goes from one end of the protein to another.
Sorry?
Correlation function, when you go with the same
yes.
from one end of protein to another, which is very, very strict.
Yes.
Additional condition.
Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, anyway, I don't know how to do the other one.
I have a question.
Yes.
When you say that the sequence of 153 monomers in a certain random sequence that I picked is garbage, how do you know it's garbage?
No, that's the phone form. No.
Most likely.
Just because it has not been isolated and characterized doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's the same.
That exists. No, you can synthesize whatever you want. Okay, you can synthesize by chemical synthesis or whatever.
You can synthesize any sequence of monomers, right?
Any sequence of monomers.
Okay.
Now the question is, will it fold to a unique structure or not? Actually, there are two questions. Will it fold to a unique structure, and how long will it take to fold to that structure? So, but let's ask the question, will it fold to a unique structure? And what I want to show you is that sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Depending on the model you take.
So, how do we characterize a sequence of monomers as garbage? That's what I'm getting.
Garbage is that it doesn't fold in a unique state.
To a unique structure.
I mean, that's
a if a sequence falls in 20, 100 different structures, then it's
because you cannot expect it to have any function if the function is associated to the geometry, to the structure, to the three-dimensional. I didn't say, but usually if you have a protein.
So do we understand why biological activity is associated with a very, very small number of states?
I don't, but usually, okay, so the picture.
Probably due to evolution.
Yeah, evolution. Let's say evolution.
For enzymes, you need to gain the right reservoirs to do
it.
Yeah,
but if you're doing with a much smaller protein, why do you need such a big...
This
I mean, you have, let's say, 1,000 atoms you use on each end to make the active site. Why do you need 1,000 atoms to stabilize
besides,
such a small region?
Actually.
That's a relevant
question. Highly strong, because one well-defined structure. It is a miracle if you have 100 well-defined structures.
How many do you have in New Zealand? I think we have 100. Tens of them. I'm thinking of the zeolite area, okay? Zeolite area, it's inorganic materials.
Yes.
20 years ago, they said, you know, we found a zeolite. And then 5 years later, they say, you know what, there are 10 of them. And now there are like 130 of them.
Yes.
Okay?
No,
so every day...
It's mainly folklore.
Right. So we don't... What I want to understand, because I'm not familiar with the area, do we know or we don't know?
So there are experiments... Okay, let's say.
Do we know what?
Whether it's wrong or not. Whether it's garbage or not.
Right.
So garbage is a... Yes.
Given a sequence,
okay, so
how
do
you calculate? Let's just
you cannot calculate.
You cannot calculate.
No, calculation is irrelevant. What you can do is synthesize it, and then what happens is you cannot crystallize it. So if you cannot crystallize it, you don't know the structure. And if you don't know the structure, you say, well, probably it's not the structure.
But if you can't see the sign, you probably disappear, right? Yeah, you know.
Not only. You can look ahead of near me, for example,
yes.
On a mark, and you see if you have unique,
yes, okay.
Something unique in this signal.
You can look for secondary structure.
Asymmetry.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Not only secondary structure,
okay,
this is structure of aromatic rings.
Yes, okay, but you could see
definite symmetry.
But you could have a random heteropolymers which fold with a very very small yield. 99% of it would fold in completely in garbage, and 1%
yeah.
Fold and you wouldn't see a signal. And doesn't mean, and of course, if you were in the if you had a
no
chaperone or whatever, you would have a much bigger yield. So there is, I think there is no real answer to that question. And okay. So the partition function for this type of model is the following. You take, so I write it in a discrete form, but for the calculations it's simpler to use a model. So you replace the monomers by you take a coarse grained representation where Ri is the typical position of the monomer, and so there is a two body interaction which is here, which is and a three body interaction to prevent the collapse. Okay, so, and then the question is, what do you take for the interaction terms? So, of course, I'm not saying that it's very realistic, but it's simple. So usually what you take for, you take only contact interactions, which are very short range for the V here. You take very short range interaction for the W also. And what you take, okay, let me try to explain a little bit. The collapse and the phase transition is usually governed by the two-body term. It's the two-body term which tells you whether the protein will collapse, will make a specific fold or so. And so a simple approximation is to, and the three-body term is repulsive and is there just to prevent that the system will collapse at infinite density. So essentially one takes a three-body term which is non-specific, which is a the same for all amino acids, and then you take a two-body interaction, which is a delta function, that's a contact interaction, and with a GIJ, and the GIJ are some random variable which I will specify, so you can have various models for the GIJ, and this is what we call random heteropolymer models. And so you can take GIJ to be independent random pairs, like in spin glasses. You can take products of random variables, like in Mattis models in spin systems, or sums of independent variables, and that's called something. So in order to do the calculation, I'll introduce another N, equal zero. But this one is a bad N. So, in disordered systems, what you have to do is you have to average the free energy. And the free energy is the log of the partition function. And of course, from a calculational point of view, in general, you cannot calculate log z because it's complicated. So you use a trick, which is the deepest trick in disordered physics. You take z to the n, take the average, and take the derivative with respect to n at n equals 0. And this formula, if you know this formula, you know physics of disorder. So it's the most widely used trick in disordered systems. Okay, so the simplest model that one can think of is to, so I discussed before a model where all the monomers were hydrophobic. So the simplest thing one can imagine is to take some monomers to be hydrophilic and some other monomers to be hydrophobic. So it's a model which was introduced on the lattice by Chan and Deal, yes? And they call it the HP model. So certain monomers are polar hydrophilic, certain monomers are hydrophobic.
And the question is, you put this in water, so the monomers which are polar want to be surrounded by water, the other ones want to avoid water, and so you make a kind of micellar structure like this, where everybody is happy. And the question is, what is the phase diagram of this system? So the way to model the two-body potential in that case is lambda I plus lambda j, delta of I minus R j. So this is the Jij, the Gij I was talking about before. If you take it in this form, and the lambdas are some kind of hydrophilic or hydrophobic charge, which characterize each amino acid. And so if lambda is positive, if you have two positive lambda, the potential is repulsive, which means that lambda positive corresponds to hydrophilic monomers, because hydrophilic monomers repel each other. If both lambda are negative, then the potential is attractive, which is a characteristic of hydrophobic residues will attract each other. And that's it. So the model, which is the simplest to study, which can be simply studied, is to take lambda I to be a Gaussian random independent variable. Now, if you tell me that there is some correlation function in the sequence that I could use, then I would be happy to put it in this way, right? It's just the distribution of the lambda I. If you tell me that if I have five hydrophilic, then I will have three hydrophobic, it's easy to put in this distribution, right? So by doing this quenched average, over the sequence, what you will be able to say is things about the typical behavior of a Raman heteropolynar chain. What it will do. So lambda zero is the average hydrophobicity or hydrophilicity of the sequence, and lambda is the width of the hydrophilicity. So then you can perform the quenched average, and then you have to do all kinds of approximation, mean peak theory with the replicas and ground state dominance for the polymer part. I don't want to go into the details. The results are the following. For any average hydrophobicity of the system, whatever small it is, there is a collapse transition at low temperature. If you go to low enough, if you have a number of residues which are hydrophobic, whatever small it is, eventually it will lead to the collapse of the chain at low enough temperature. And the second result is that in this model, there is no replica symmetry gradient. So I'm not going to discuss too much that, because some people don't know what it means, but I just say for those who know what it means. In this specific model, because of the nature of the disorder, which is this additive form, there is no replica, there cannot be any replica symmetry. Now, which means that there is no glass phase, essentially.
Talk about these phases, once you take the thermodynamic limit.
Yes.
Problem.
You work always in the thermodynamic limit, because when you do this kind of field, and it's essentially ground state dominance.
For this kind of HP model, I mean, what's the thermodynamic limit? Thermodynamic limit, meaning you're talking about boundary effect.
Thermodynamic limit means that, what happens, you write, and you start from the model that I wrote, and you introduce variables which are like concentration variables, and then you do mean field on this. So by doing this mean field, you do you take the thermodynamic limit. Let me show the phase diagram. Yes.
Comment. I think in the uncollapsed phases, self-avoiding walk, so there are really no boundary effects.
Right. Well, it's, we talk about in the collapse phase, when the picture, you have the red outside. And
no, but this is
inside.
A picture. It's not going.
Yeah, yeah. But something like that would not. Well,
yeah.
Sure, not there.
Of course. No. I will show you. I will try to show you the picture. Actually, there have been numerical simulation on that, but what I present is essentially the result of this simplified analytic calculation, which are in agreement, actually. I mean, as far as the phase diagram is concerned, with the numerical simulation. So in the strongly hydrophobic case, maybe when lambda zero, the average hydrophobicity is small enough, there is a second order collapse transition which is driven by the lambda zero term. I remind you, sorry. You have, if you write the interaction as lambda, if you extract the lambda zero term, so there is a constant term which is attractive, which is this lambda zero, the average, and then a fluctuating term. So if lambda zero, if this lambda zero is large enough, it will be enough to induce a collapse of the polymer. And this is it's a collapse which is very similar to the ordinary theta polymer. And the picture is that you have dominantly one color, the hydrophobic, and it will collapse in a uniform way. There is no separation between the hydrophilic and hydrophobic. Entropically, you wouldn't gain enough. The separation of the hydrophilic and hydrophobic residues wouldn't be enough to compensate the entropy loss of the middle separation. And you have a kind of uniform collapse, which is second order, and which resembles very much the standard theta collapse. Now, in the case of hydrophilic, where lambda zero is larger than this critical lambda c, and even for lambda zero positive, which means for in the case where on the average the chain is hydrophilic, the collapse is first order, and it is induced by the disorder fluctuation. Now, the disorder fluctuations are coming to the free-body term for the following reason. If you remember in the Hamiltonian, there is a term which is e to the minus sum over I of lambda I sum over I and j delta r I minus r j. This is it was lambda I plus lambda j, so if I do. So if I introduce replicas, there is a sum over alpha, where the index alpha goes from 1 to n. And now if I do the Gaussian average of this over lambda, it will generate a term which goes like e to the lambda square over 2, sum over I, sum over alpha and beta, sum over j and k. So you get something like r alpha, r j alpha. Ri minus Rj. So in this term, if you isolate the term alpha equals beta, you see that there is an attractive three-body term, the alpha equals beta, and there was a constant term e to the minus w sum over alpha, sum over I, j, k, delta, delta. And there is a tricritical, not a tricritical point, it's a tetracritical point actually. No, there is a point where the three-body term vanishes. And that point drives the first order transition. And this first order transition, in fact, it is not an ordinary theta point, and it is not also a glass transition because, as I said before, there is never replica symmetry breaking. The physical picture is that in the case when the system is weakly hydrophobic or hydrophilic, it will break into small micellar-like structures because where the system will put the hydrophobic core here and separate by this is the kind of picture that you see and that you can see also numerically, and the size of these objects is of course finite, and you could think of it as the multi-domain proteins where essentially proteins there are other things than just simple hydrophilic hydrophobic interactions, but in this HP model that's really the kind of phase diagram that you would have. So it's a first order transition, which means that you have metastability, retardation effect. And of course, when you have a first order transition, you have a strong reduction in entropy because you have a latent heat. And there is a delta S, which is much larger in the first order transition than in the second order transition.
And
we at some point go back to the second order? I mean,
yes, there is
the weakest order, and then
yes. Let me show you the phase diagram. No, there is the. How can you go back to?
I mean, it's
okay.
The weakest order, and then we include the weakest order.
Okay. Yes.
If these domains are always connected by one piece of the chain, or the chain can go to one domain, then another domain, then come back.
It's the same, all this is the same chain.
Yeah, this is the same chain, but it goes to another domain,
yes.
May come back.
Obviously, it would come back, yes, of course. But the point is that there is some kind of separation of the hydrophobic parts, which are protected, which the small hydrophobic parts are protected by hydrophilic parts. And then there is a kind of microphase separation taking place in the system. This is not a macrophase, it's always a scale. Difficult to calculate. You would have to solve for instant terms in the mid-field theory. It's a theory which goes back 5A. You have to go to the 5A term. So I don't know. At least I haven't done the calculation.
But isn't it determined basically by the ratio between the hydrophilic and hydrophobic?
Yes.
So
but
what's the question?
The question is how does it scale with that? Right? Mm-hmm. Something like
that.
How does it scale with the ratio? But with this, which is this lambda zero over lambda.
If you assume these are some spherical objects, you know, just roughly, then you get a number, right?
Yes, you're right. Yes, you could.
So you should expect it to be very different from that.
No, that's a. Yeah, probably you can estimate it like this. Yeah, you can probably estimate.
Yes.
Yes, but what I'm saying is that from the mid-field equations which you get, which are some kind of Landau kind of equation, it's very difficult to. Maybe some scaling, or maybe some. No, what you can do is some kind of. Once you have the free energy, this Landau kind of free energy, what you can take is a modulated kind of density, and then you can calculate what is the size of the modulation which will appear. This we have done. We never published it, but this is doable. You can do it in kind of variation. So just to finish before you're all dead, I present another model, which is I have plenty of other. Okay, so the random bond model is a model which is very much used by people to do protein. I don't know why they like this so much, this model. So the model is another extreme of the model that I was showing before. It's a model where the Gij are random independent variables. So in that case, you cannot define a sequence, really. There is no sequence in the problem. There is random independent variables, right? Because you have n square independent variables, and if it was a sequence, you would have.
You can just draw the phase diagram of the previous model?
Ah, yes, sorry, I went a little too fast. So the phase diagram is here. So if I take everything in units of lambda, which is the width of the disorder, so this is lambda c, the critical c. So below, when it's strongly hydrophobic, you go from high temperature, you're in a swollen phase, you cross a second order, which is the equivalent of this theta line, and to a collapse phase. And if you continue to go down, you have a first order transition in the collapse phase, between a liquid and a modulated, some kind of, there is some Q which appears in the system, and then there is this first order line. Now, the other region, which is this hydrophilic or weakly hydrophobic case, you go directly from the swollen phase, to this small collapsed phase with these bubbles. And that's how it goes. And this line goes to zero as lambda zero goes to when it becomes more and more hydrophobic.
In between is that slice in the momentum globe?
Here, yes. Yeah. So then, from a dynamical point of view, now, if you want the protein to fold fast,
too fast, too fall fast. You don't want it to be on this, too much on this side, because when you have a first order transition, you would have a lot of metastatal states, which are not good for the, if you want to make a fast folding. And the transition should not be too much in this region, because then you would lose the first order. It would be a second order.
But you don't have structure in this one. I mean, would you have a folding? No.
There is a finite entropy everywhere. Okay. In all the low temperature phase, there is a finite entropy, configuration entropy, so there is no folding for sure. But if, okay, it's the simplest way to put some kind of sequence information in the model. So there is no no folding, of course, finite entropy at low temperature. And what I just want to say is that you expect the fastest kinetics to be in the surrounding of this point, because here it's preempted by the, there you have the first order transition, and you don't want to go too much here, because in that case it would be a second order, which experimentally is not. Okay. So that's not for this one. So, good. Now, so the random bomb model, actually we did it because by analogy with the spin glass case, with the Sherrington Kirkpatrick case, but okay, I don't think it's so interesting in the sense that you lose any sequence information. There is no, you have n square independent variables, whereas you should have n parameters. Anyway, so the distribution of the Gij is just Gaussian with an average G0 and a width G. And so when you do the quenched average, which you can do, so you write the partition function, you replicate, you do the quenched average, and then you find that there are two other parameters, the density or concentration like order, which means that the replicated partition function, after doing the averages, can be written in this form as a functional integral over these two order parameters. So this is like a density. It's written here. It's a sum of I of n 1 to n delta of r minus r I alpha. So it's really a concentration of monomers of r. And there is another one, which is this q alpha beta of r r prime. And q alpha beta of r r prime is the equivalent in spin glasses of what we call an overlap distribution. So this order parameter essentially tells you if it's non-zero, it means that the system, the polymer will freeze in some state. And that if you take another copy of the system, it will freeze either in the same state or in that there is freezing. So this order parameter, this overlap order parameter, is really a measure of the freeze. It's similar to what was discussed before, 2 days ago.
What is RE?
RI is the position of monomer I.
Alpha?
Alpha is this replica index. That's this trick to average over the zone. Okay, anyway, it's it's a little heavy formalism, because it's a little bit more complicated than spin glasses, because you have the chain degrees of freedom and the... But you can do various approximations. And the result is the following. You find that there are two transitions, one which is t theta, one which I call tf. So t theta is like a theta point. It's a transition, so you have two other parameters. So what happens is that you can have in the high temperature phase, both other parameters are zero. Rho equals zero means that you're in a swollen phase, because in a swollen phase, the density of monomers is rho is n over V, and V, the volume, since the radius of gyration is mu, is Rn to the mu, so it's n to the mu V. So you see that if mu is smaller than 1 over V, the density goes to 0. So since all this is done in the thermodynamic limit, so the only case when the density is finite is when mu equals 1 over V. As one expects, 1 over V, which means 1 third in 3D or so. So when in this game you find rho equals 0, it means that you are in a swollen phase. So there is a temperature T theta where you have a transition between a phase rho equals 0, which means a swollen phase, and Q equals zero. And no, that's okay. So in the high temperature, this is the phase of the system. Rho equals zero, Q equals zero. So it's a purely self-avoiding mode. Then between the two transition temperature, there is a collapsed or globular phase with rho not equal to zero and Q equals zero. So Q equals zero means that it's not a frozen phase, it's a liquid phase, and rho not equal to zero means that it's a compact phase. So you go from a swollen phase to a compact phase, but which has a kind of a liquid structure, and it's really like a molten globule or something like that. And this phase, of course, has a finite large entropy. Then at this point, there is a new phase transition, and this phase transition takes place in the collapsed, in the globular phase. And in this case, it's this second order parameter, this overlap order parameter, which has a transition from zero to a finite value. And this transition, you need a once, what's technically we call a, is called a one-step replica symmetry breaking. And this low temperature phase is what you would call a frozen phase. And it's very similar to what you have in mid-field, in spin glasses, at least in mean-field spin glasses, namely that there is a very large number of metastable states at low temperature. And there is so at low temperature you have a quite large number of metastable states, but there are what is called dominant states. So there is a very small number of states among these low-lying states. There is a small number of states which are dominantly, which are sizably lower than the others. That's some result from, it depends only it's due to the type of replica symmetry breaking that exists. And of course, what was exciting to people is that these dominant states are slightly reminiscent of the native state of Schrödinger. So this is, of course, typical of what you have in a completely random. It's not even a sequence in this kind of problem.
Excuse me. Yes. How this answer depends on the average value of your interaction parameter?
Okay. So of course, if the average value of the parameter is too large, then the system will simply not collapse. So there is two parameters. There is the G0, which is the average, and then there is a fluctuation Gij. So if G0 is repulsive, for instance, you may, if it's too repulsive, the system will not collapse. So there is a value of G0 below which you will have this phase diagram. And for instance, at G0 equals 0, you will already have that.
And is it possible to go to this frozen phase without coming into
a collapse?
Into cold state?
Not in this model.
Not in this model.
Not in this model. But that's specific to this. You don't have a direct freezing where that would mean a transition where you would go where the two other parameters would be zero and suddenly both would be zero simultaneously. Okay. And that in this model doesn't exist.
Okay.
So this model has been studied on lattices and
that's somehow if train is in glasses also to that you would have random field maybe.
Yes.
You would have it's most fit with
Yes.
And then a very low T you would.
Yes. Right.
So
but here it's
so it's very model dependent.
Yes. Yes, of course. Yeah. So the model what did I use more? Yes. Okay, so I think I can stop here. Essentially, what I wanted to say is that if you take a random heteropolymer on this kind of interaction, that's kind of a phase diagram that you get. And so it has been studied on lattices, so people have done many, many simulations on so 3 by 3 by 3 lattice. Now I think it's 3 by 3 by 4. Or 3 by 4 by 4, I don't know. Better?
No, but these are exact enumerations.
Yeah, you can do it. Yeah, of course. Exact enumeration, so there is 106,331, something like that. Configuration of compact blocks. Sorry?
No one is in.
Probably not.
Two.
Yes. And so what they find, what people find is, of course, now it's where evolution comes in and selection and whatever, that if you take a random sequence and if you try to solve to fold it, not exactly, but by Monte Carlo this time, if you take any completely random sequence, essentially it will take a huge time to fold to its native state. So by exact enumeration, you know what is the native state, what is the ground state of the system, right? And the ground state of the system is unique by definition because there is no reason why it should be degenerate. So if you take, because it's such a small system, so it's not degenerate, you have a ground state, which is a state lower than the others. So you know exactly by enumeration what is the ground state. Now you can ask the question, if I take the chain completely unfolded and I do some Monte Carlo dynamics, so what people find is that if you take a random sequence, essentially it will take forever to fold into the native structure. That's the claim of the people. Forever means like 1 million or 10 million iterations. Whereas if you take some sequences which are so-called specifically designed, then they will fold much faster into their ground state. And so then there is all this idea that evolution has selected the sequences which fold faster, etc. So this has had a lot of implications of on the way to design a model for proteins and possible dynamics, but we will hear from that in the coming week.
Well, thank you very much. I think that helped a lot getting us warmed up for the coming weeks. Since everybody of course now wants to know where the 117 or 112 comes from, but I think we will push that to some later part of the workshop and have another day. So I just want to wish you a good weekend, those who leave us a good trip back. And otherwise, I'll see you on Monday at 2 p.m. So the Gary Storm was only coming at lunchtime, so there will be no morning talk on Monday. We start at 2 p.m. And also,
happy hour.
There's the happy hour at the, what is this place called?
And the Beachside Cafe, right?
Beachside Cafe, since 4:30 already, so.